Here's a look at our top stories this hour. France, Germany, Italy, and Romania support Ukraine receiving immediate official candidate status to join the EU. The U.S. stock indexes take a nosedive a day after the Federal Reserve's large interest rate hike aimed at containing runaway inflation. Also, Iran, Russia, and Turkey expressed their commitment to the sovereignty and territorial integrity of Syria during a meeting in the Kazakh capital, Astana. Good to have you with us. French President Emmanuel Macron says his country, alongside Italy, Germany, and Romania, support granting an immediate EU candidate status to Ukraine. Macron made the remarks at a joint news conference after meeting with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. The French president said Paris would step up arms deliveries to Kiev. Meanwhile, the Ukrainian president said he has given the visiting EU leaders sanctions proposals against Russia, calling on them to increase pressure on Moscow. Macron, German Chancellor Schulz, and Italian Prime Minister Draghi arrived in Kiev by train on Thursday morning. Upon arrival, Macron told reporters Ukraine must resist and win the war against Russia. Meanwhile, Russia says it hopes the visit is not just for pumping Ukraine with weapons, calling more arms useless for Kiev. Secretary General of the CIPI Foundation, Paolo Raffone, joined us earlier. He says the visit by three European leaders to Kiev represents the EU's different political sensitivities regarding Ukraine. Here's more.
The three head of government who have been or are visiting Ukraine, in fact, represent different sensitivities on the possibility to continue supporting Ukraine. The problem here is what is the end? Where are we going? What we want to achieve? And these three governments have different opinions on this issue. Moreover, the European sentiment is evidently split. It just came out yesterday, an ECFR research that shows that Europeans are deeply divided, with 35% requesting peace, which means end the war as soon as possible, and only 25% requesting justice, which means pressing more to get to a point to punish Russia. And this is clear in the minds of governments. It's not so much clear in the minds of the EU leadership, which is mostly on the shadow of a NATO approach, which is dictated by the United States. So further support, military support to Ukraine.
As the Russian and Ukrainian armies fight for control of the Luhansk region, our reporter Johnny Miller visits a village on the outskirts of Donetsk, which is caught in the middle of the artillery between the opposing sides.
Humanitarian aid being loaded into a lorry. I'm heading with pro-Russian volunteers to a village near the front line, which is constantly under shelling in order to deliver much-needed supplies. Despite the destruction all around, incredibly, people still live here. We stop off next to the final checkpoint. Beyond is no man's land, the grey zone between the opposing armies. Artillery can be heard. It's unclear whether it's Russian or Ukrainian.
Now it is from both sides. Artillery duels. And we're in the middle. The shells are flying over our heads. And they might fall here, so let's just gradually move away.
Pieces of shrapnel like this are supposed to hit us. This one is small. They're bigger ones. Look how sharp it is. They cut through flesh like a sieve. These are Ukrainian gifts to our children. They're different shapes and sizes. You could keep it as a souvenir from Donbass.
Unexpectedly, in this wasteland, a bus pulls up. The man tells me his house was destroyed yesterday. He shows me his wounds. I asked him why he's come back. To get some documents and feed his cat, he says. A crowd is gathered at the drop-off point, hungry for the humanitarian aid.
There was that video showing a woman from Western Ukraine sitting on the road embracing her two children and asking, how could it be so that her house was destroyed by Russian shelling? She should ask the woman whose three children died in a bathroom from Ukrainian shelling how she felt. I also have children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren. I want to live in peace here in Donbas, not watch all this going on.
It's noticeable here that most people are women and children. The men have joined the armies.
Now, the front line is only a few hundred meters away. There's a lot of emotion here, understandably, about this war. Some people here even tell me they have cousins who are fighting in the Ukrainian army, while their sons and husbands are fighting for the pro-Russians. This war has divided the country. It's also divided villages like this.
My son died on the 3rd of November. He'd been on the front line for 8 years. He went there in 2014 as a volunteer, and now he's dead. What for, I ask, what for?
Those who remain don't leave because it's their home, and they have nowhere else to go. They tell me this used to be a pleasant place to live. The same can be said of many other parts of Ukraine. The longer this war goes on, the more of this pleasant land will be destroyed. Johnny Miller, Donbass.
The United States stock indices take a sharp nosedive after the Federal Reserve reports its biggest interest rate hike since 1994. The Dow Jones, S&P 500, along with Nasdaq Composite, and other growth shares all slumped. On Wednesday, the Federal Reserve approved the largest interest rate increase, signaling an aggressive path to fight 40-year high inflations. This is after the May Consumer Price Index showed inflation rose to well over 8%. The Federal Reserve has shifted gears this year from propping up the U.S. economy during the pandemic to trying to plug off a surge in consumer prices. The Bank of England has hiked its main interest rate for a fifth straight time as it forecasts inflation to soar further this year to above 11%. The bank raised the cost of borrowing by a quarter point to 1.25%. That's the highest level since the global financial crisis in 2009. The pound slumped 1% against the dollar following the announcement. Currently, inflation in Britain stands at 9%, the highest level in 40 years. Data this week also revealed the first rise in the UK unemployment rate since the end of 2020. The war in Ukraine and subsequent energy crisis, as well as an economy still battered by the pandemic, are among the main reasons for Britain's economic woes. Britain says the European Court of Human Rights overstepped its powers in grounding a flight of asylum seekers minutes before it took off to Rwanda. Deputy Prime Minister Dominic Raab says London will keep working to make sure the deportation flights will take place in the weeks ahead. The UK government is planning to send migrants arriving in the country thousands of kilometers away to Rwanda. But the decision has triggered massive criticism from the UN, the Church of England, and rights groups. And on Tuesday, the European Court canceled the first flight with a last-minute ruling. The legal battle has led some in Prime Minister Boris Johnson's Conservative Party to call for Britain to pull out of the European Convention on Human Rights. But Raab says for now, London will stay in the convention.
Grounded right before takeoff from a military airport in southwest England as the legal wrangling over the fate of those due to be deported played out. The crew of the £500,000 taxpayer-funded flight to Rwanda soon realized they weren't going anywhere as an 11th-hour intervention by the European Human Rights Council granted a reprieve to most of the seven Middle Eastern asylum seekers on board to the delight of critics of the government's immigration policy.
I was delighted. It really instilled my confidence in the judicial system that people could actually pick out favourable politics and look behind that and identify potential breaches of human rights.
A defiant UK Prime Minister, though, says he is pushing on with his policy and that he may now contemplate withdrawing from the European Convention on Human Rights.
What we want to do is to show the people traffickers that they're breaking the law, they're risking people's lives, and it won't work anyway. Now, will it be necessary to change some laws to help us as we go along. It may very well be.
At the moment, the UK's Interior Ministry forcibly removes anyone it deems inadmissible to claim asylum in the UK on a one-way charter flight to Rwanda, and houses them at facilities like this one in the capital, Kigali, a policy that has drawn fierce criticism from charities to the Church of England to rights activists.
Well, the government argument is they're doing this to put people traffickers out of business, but people such as yourself want the policy scrapped altogether. Why?
Immigration, asylum, and human rights are not at the top of the priority of this government's way of working with others, you know, less fortunate than themselves. We see the situation in Rwanda as being dressed up as something that it's absolutely not. I still have clients who are Rwandan refugees.
The UK has reportedly paid cash-strapped Rwanda $148 million up front for the deportation deal, and plans on making additional payments to the East African country based on the number of asylum seekers it deports.
The UK government says it's ready to do anything, including changing the law to make those deportation flights happen. But for now, a respite for desperate asylum seekers facing a terrifying future. Saeed Bouriza, London.
Russia, Turkey, and Iran have met again under the Astana format to discuss Syria. The three parties have reaffirmed commitment to the sovereignty and territorial integrity of the Arab country. In a joint statement following their 18th such meeting, the three countries condemned the increased activities of terrorist groups in Syria. They said they are determined to continue working together to combat terrorism in the Arab country. The three countries said they have agreed to make further efforts to ensure calm in the de-escalation area of Syria's Idlib. According to the joint statement, the next Astana meeting on Syria will be held in Kazakhstan in the second half of this year. The Israeli newspaper Haaretz reported that the Palestinian leadership informed the U.S. administration of its refusal to hold a Palestinian-Israeli meeting during the planned visit of U.S. President Joe Biden to the region as long as the Israeli occupation will not recognize the so-called two-state solution. Our correspondent Mona Kendi reports from Ramallah.
Ahead of a planned visit by U.S. President Joe Biden to the region next month, Israeli media revealed that the American administration had raised the possibility of holding a meeting between the Palestinian Authority and Israel, but the Palestinians have rejected the idea. According to the Israeli daily Haaretz, the Palestinians informed the Americans that they would only accept such a meeting if all parties agreed on advancing a two-state solution based on the 1967 borders.
The Biden administration, with its offer to have a kind of a meeting between the Palestinians and the Israelis, is trying just to get out of the hook. It's trying to say that they are interested in doing something in the area. At the same time, what they are offering is just a kind of a arrangement, economic arrangements, to make life a little bit much better under the occupation. Now, the Palestinian Authority and the Palestinians in general are aiming at ending the occupation and establishing a Palestinian state.
The Palestinians, however, want from the Americans to reopen the U.S. consulate in East Al-Quds and to remove the Palestine Liberation Organization, PLO, from the U.S. terror list. These demands had been made during a meeting between Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas and Assistant Secretary of State for Near Eastern Affairs Barbara Leaf in Ramallah.
Biden's visit carries with it many risks, including shaping the situation in the region in favor of U.S. interests and those of Israel. We have demanded from the U.S. some issues that it can make unilaterally and don't require hollow meetings. It's clear the U.S. will ignoring the major cause, which is the Palestinian cause.
On Tuesday, the White House confirmed Biden's first trip to West Asia region next month, during which he will visit the occupied Palestine, followed by a trip to Saudi Arabia. Israel's foreign minister has said that his country was looking to Biden's trip next month to help improve relations with Saudi Arabia. U.S. President Joe Biden is planning a visit to Saudi Arabia as part of the Riyadh summit. Biden says he will be focusing on Israel as a key issue for talks during his Saudi visit. Palestinians, on the other hand, say the Biden's visit to the region would only be symbolic. Mona Qandil, Occupied Ramallah.
Iran urges the U.N. Nuclear Agency to drop its past allegations that accuse the country of running a nuclear program with a possible military dimension. Tehran says the so-called PMD case of Iran's nuclear program has been closed under the 2015 deal, also known as the JCPOA, and reopening the case will hinder efforts to revive the agreement. The remarks were made by the chief of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, Mohammad Islami. The official said the PMD allegations against Iran's nuclear program are based on fabricated information provided to the agency by the Israeli regime. Islami's remarks come after the IAEA passed a resolution against Iran last week. The resolution called on Iran to provide answers to traces of uranium enrichment found at three undeclared sites. Tehran described the resolution as politically motivated and scaled back its cooperation with the agency by switching off a number of monitoring cameras in its nuclear sites. A senior Iranian diplomat says the Islamic Republic will not allow the Israeli regime to promote Iranophobia and legitimize its anti-Iran campaign. Deputy Foreign Minister Ali Bogheri said Tehran has successfully countered the United States' so-called maximum pressure policy. Elsewhere in his remarks, the top official said Iran's diplomacy is marked by strategic prudence, bold decision-making, and strong action. He said among other key features of Tehran's diplomacy is paying attention to a variety of economic deals and trade partners, as well as state or stable economic relations. He further noted that Iran's diplomacy will not compromise on national interests and security. Political commentator Keenan Mansfield says the United States and Israel pursue politically motivated moves against Iran through the IAEA to pave the way for toughening sanctions on the Islamic Republic. Take a listen.
Picking the statement that went to the IAEA is very true, because as soon as mainstream media here in the United States picks this story up, which won't take long, it's rather rich, it's ironic, it's also a bit horrifying that the closest ally, the greatest ally of the U.S., which is Israel, wants to accuse Iran and try to turn this into a political move to further sanction Iran and try to hurt Iran and force it further and further out of the international community than it already has been. I find it then pretty ironic or hypocritical that Israel doesn't allow any oversight on their nuclear programs or really on their country or so-called country whatsoever.
Well, that's your world news for now. Stay tuned.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
What is happening in Palestine is not removed from what is happening in the U.S. It is increased gun violence. The consequences of the gun lobby and weapons manufacturers in the U.S. have destructive and deeply unjust consequences all over the world, including in the murder of Shirin Abu Aghaleh. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Yusra Bitar, writer. This article is published under the heading, Big Players in Finance Profited from Gun Used to Kill Shirin Abu Aqile. Stay tuned for the second part of this article, please. Although not surprising given the role overseeing a gun company, it is worth mentioning that these board members are tied to major reactionary forces in the US that contribute to preventing actions in response to the increasing number of mass shootings. Sandy Foreman has a lifetime position at NRA Executive Council and has been on their board since 1992. She also served as the NRA's vice president from 1998 to 2005 and president from 2005 to 2007. Roger is a frequent donor to the NRA. In 2011, they pledged $1 for the NRA for every Roger gun sold as part of its first million gun challenge. By the end of the campaign in 2012, Roger had donated $1.2 million to the NRA. In 2015 and 2016, Sturm Roger directed $10 million to the NRA and $1.5 million in the following 2 years. Sturm Roger CEO Chris Kaloy is on the National Shooting Sports Foundation NSSF Board of Governors. The NSSF calls itself the Firearm Industry Trade Association. Benefiting from gun sales from multiple angles, Kaloy is also a board member for Velocity Outdoor, another manufacturer of rifles, pistol, and ammunition products. In 2021, he was compensated $3,435,000 by Roger, and he took in $9,557,993 from the company between 2019 and 2021 in total. His 150,395 shares of Roger's stock, as reported in Roger's 2022 proxy filing alone, are worth close to $10 million as of June 6, 2022. Philip Whitman is on the board of Vecross Incorporation, which ranks in the top 10 arms manufacturers in the world. Oddly, these directors who profit from destructive weapons are able to burnish their reputations through other positions. For example, Ronald Whitaker, according to his page, is on the advisory board on the Indiana University for the Manufacturing Policy Initiative, which is part of the Public and Environmental Affairs School. He is also, again, according to his LinkedIn page, the vice chair of the Savannah Music Festival in Georgia. Georgia is one of the states with a guns everywhere bill that was signed into law in 2014. Savannah witnesses gun violence often. Its state university had a shooting this past April. Roger describes itself as a company of arms makers for responsible citizens and as a model of corporate and community responsibility. But the truth is that the weapons they produce and distribute are used against journalists, unarmed protesters, children, and other communities. In its latest proxy statement, Roger also reaffirmed its deep commitment to human rights. Ironically, their filing also shows that the company opposed a proposal to uphold the UN guiding principles on business and human rights by committing for a human rights impact assessment, which a majority of shareholders ultimately voted for. The company stated that it opposed this resolution because the outcome that proponents advocate and actually seek will harm the company, destroy shareholder value, and undermine the Second Amendment rights of the company's customers. The proposal shareholders approved is non-binding. The risk factors in the company's annual report specify that misconducts, fraud, or improper activities by employees or contractors could have a material adverse impact on business and reputation. Such misconduct could include the failure to comply with federal, state, local, or foreign government procurement regulations. But in the case of Shirin Abu Aghile's murder, the misconduct committed by its client and customer, the Zionist regime, goes against international law. Human rights experts, for example, have said for her killing may constitute a war crime. Roger and Smith and Wesson, another major gun manufacturer, are being pressured by other nations as well as around the harm caused by their gun business. For example, Mexico filed a $10 billion lawsuit against the companies last August, holding them responsible for the deadly floods of weapons crossing into the country. It's not far-fetched to suggest that tragedy, crisis, and mass discontent have left companies like Roger at an advantage. Gun sales in the U.S. increased significantly during the pandemic. Based on their proxy statement filings, Roger's sales increased 28% in 2021 compared to 2020, with production also increasing 30% and earnings increasing 73% in that period. The share prices of gun and ammunition companies often rise after mass shootings, and investors often anticipate a spike in sales ahead of calls for stricter gun laws. Roger gained more than 4% after the deadly shooting in Uvalde, Texas. Simply put, Roger profits from selling weapons that are involved in the death and oppression of people around the world. The upward trend of guns and military budgets in the U.S. is also reflected in the increasing military aid the country gives the Zionist regime unconditionally. The U.S. is the biggest supplier of military aid to the fabricated regime of Israel. According to the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, SIPRI, 83% of the Zionist regime's arms imports came from the U.S. between 1950 to 2020. Also, 80% of all aid that the U.S. regime has sent the Zionist regime since 1967 has come in the form of military aid. In 2020 alone, the U.S. provided $3.8 billion, which is part of a greater and larger $38 billion deal over a 10-year period. Despite the Leahy Law in the U.S. that prohibits the export of U.S. defense articles to military units being used in human rights abuses, no Israeli regime unit has been held accountable under this law. These military aid deals are used to purchase weapons from companies like Roger. The campaign No Roger Guns to the Israeli regime has documented over 200 cases of Palestinians being killed or injured by Roger guns. Sturm Roger is directly benefiting from the gun violence in the U.S. and abroad. Its close connection to the NRA helps it push for policies such as less gun control that advances its profit-making. What is happening in Palestine is not removed from what is happening in the U.S. with its increased gun violence. The consequences of the gun lobby and weapons manufacturers in the U.S. have destructive and deeply unjust consequences all over the world, including in the murder of Shirin Abu Aghile. Roger is one of the stakeholders personally invested in the upkeep of the hyper-militarized and over-weaponized societies and major firms. And firms like BlackRock and Vanguard prop up and benefit from the company's business.
Food for Thought.
Hello everyone, here is a general advice from Imam Ali ibn Musa al-Raza, peace be upon him, the eighth infallible heir of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, on how to detect undesirable elements in society. Hypocrites are characterized by three features: telling lies, reneging on promises, and breaching of trust.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An introduction into Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, the cooperation and helping. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. As we know about human society, that there are always goals and we always have purposes. Together we can achieve those purposes, those goals, not personally. So having a social life is always about the collective goals which we can achieve by cooperation, by helping each other. It's not possible for us to have a social life without being in interaction with one another. And it's not possible for us to reach that collective goals about our social life without helping one another. So there is a mythical story which has been narrated in some of the cultures that a sage holds a party and he invites his disciples for this feast, and there was food and there was everything to enjoy and drink. When the disciples come and they sit for the feast, the sage says, "You can enjoy the food, but the only condition, don't bend your arm. Your arm should be spread and straight and enjoy the food." Well, it was not possible because whenever they were trying to eat something, they need to bend their arm to eat something, to enjoy the food and drinks. But it was not possible because the sage said that don't bend your arm. And everyone was looking towards other in surprise that how we are going to eat food, how this feast is, we enjoy this feast without bending our arm. The sage at last said that you can feed one another. You can give your portion of food which you take to other, and other will give you. And this way, you can enjoy the food. Actually, this story was about a very important point. The sage was telling them that the life and its blessings and its goodness cannot be reached without helping with one another. Without cooperation, we cannot reach the goodness, we cannot reach the collective purposes and goals of our life. Even in the individual goals, if we help others reach their goals, others will eventually help us to reach our goals. So it is a win-win situation. So in our collective intellectual life, we should help one another. We should cooperate with one another. That's why Quran says, وَتَعَاوَنُوا عَلَى الْبِرِّ وَالتَّقْوَى. Cooperate with one another. Help one another in the path of goodness and in the path of taqwa. Welcome back. You are listening to A to Z. As we were talking about the phenomena and quality of cooperating and helping one another and how it's important in human society, and as we gave an example of a sage and he taught his disciples how important is this quality in human society, and also we saw that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in his book emphasizes on helping one another, cooperating with one another. Well, if you can look at the society and you look at the world, it do not lack any sources of livelihood and prosperity. The world is full of sources. It's full of gifts from nature. It's full of the sources of prosperity. The only thing we lack is the cooperation and helping one another. When some of us wants to take everything for himself, and when some of us don't want to share his portion of goodness, his portion of the blessings with others, there is a problem, and it's a problem about not sharing. It's a problem about not cooperating with one another. So that's why in Islam we see that it has been narrated that the Holy Prophet said that مَنْ فَرَّجَ عَنْ أَخِيهِ الْمُسْلِمْ كُرْبَةً فَرَّجَ اللَّهُ عَنْهُ كُرْبَةً يَوْمَ الْقِيَامَةِ. Whoever solves a problem for his brother, whoever helps his brother and solves his problem, in the day of judgment, where there will be very difficult conditions, Allah will solve his problem. Allah has solved his problem and help him there. So the helping one another, cooperating with one another, is not just about this world. It is important to have a good life in this world, that we help each other, but it's also very important, and it has a positive, powerful effects on our afterlife. So we should think and rethink about how we live, and we should rethink and ponder about this reality, and may Allah help us and enable us to cooperate and help our families and the people around us, so we may share this help from others. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening to this episode of A to Z on IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. To find out more about this program, log on to our website parstoday.com/en, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
News, social news, scientific news, artistic news. with the light.
Japanese engineers have invented a four-legged robot that can easily move across rough terrain while carrying heavy loads. Japan's Kawasaki Heavy Industries has developed a quadrupled robot, believing it can help meet labor shortage in the country's aging society. Dubbed Bex after the wild goat species Ibex, the robot features large curved horns. It can walk over rough terrain or move faster on smoother surfaces using wheels tucked in its underbelly. Bex was designed to perform tasks and carry humans in agricultural settings, thereby answering a labor crunch in rural Japan.
Five young and rare Bonelli's eagles born on a breeding farm in France are taking a journey to Spain, where they will be released into the wild. These eaglets were born in captivity, which is a rare feat for this endangered species. Three of the five are ready to be released and have been fitted with GPS microchips for tracking purposes. Their initial release date was delayed because of several weeks of bird flu, which made traveling impossible. The other two eagles are too young to be reintroduced and are still being hand-fed from behind the curtain. They will make the journey sometime in July. The breeders, however, are worried about how to sustain the program as their birds begin to age.
The Bonelli's eagle is a species that is relatively scarce. In France, we must have about 40 couples, something like that, who produce about 20 chicks per year. Here, we have five chicks, but my birds are very old. Still, five chicks is not nothing for a species which relies on a small reproduction number.
Pacto also says his five pairs of eagles are aged between 18 and 30 years, and three of them are now too old to breed. He says the number of Bonelli's eagles had dropped dramatically since the 1980s, mainly to electrocution on high-voltage lines. Due to the reintroduction program, the population of these eagles has nearly doubled over the past two decades. Another breakthrough in the world of science. Japanese scientists move one step closer to creating lifelike robots by changing their physical appearance. Researchers at the University of Tokyo have developed living skin on a robotic finger. To that aim, they have submerged the robot's finger into a cylinder filled with a mixture of the natural skin components. The lab-grown skin is water-repellent, has wrinkles, and can heal itself. A member of the research team explains how the innovation will be helpful in the future. Let's take a listen.
As for challenges in the future, since we've only produced a simple skin, we would like to add various sensory organs such as the nervous system and the vascular system. We would like to further improve the function of the skin. Once we complete that, I believe that the skin itself could be used for transplantation, or use the skin as a model to develop cosmetics or drugs, or for leather products that do not require harming the animal, or to cover prosthetic limbs and legs.
The lab-grown skin is much weaker than the natural type. It's unable to survive long without nutrient supply and waste removal. For now, the team plans to address those issues and also include more sophisticated features. They want to add hair follicles, sweat glands, and sensory neurons to the skin. A Belgian company is trying to combat urban waste by transforming used coffee grounds into edible mushrooms that can also be used in construction.
The mycelium is grown in a damp cellar in Brussels. Some 5 tons of coffee grounds are collected each month from partner cafes. They are then mixed in drums where the oyster mushroom spores are added and mixed with straw in a sack. The mushrooms emerge from slashes in the sacks 15 days afterwards and are ready to be sent to shops for sales. The business owners say they are looking to expand their business and use coffee and mushrooms as an environmentally friendly alternative to plastic.
Each day we throw away a lot of coffee, and this coffee to be produced needs a lot of energy from the cultivation to the transportation to Europe, and it's just a pity not to use it more than a few minutes to drink a coffee.
The company has already tested out its fungus-based insulating tiles and received its first order of these tiles for soundproofing purposes. Jacket says they hope to produce 12 tons of the mycelium material per month when they gather enough investment. The business owner says there is no shortage of raw material as coffee is widely consumed in Belgium. Jacket says the innovation can dramatically cut down on plastic waste.
China launches 3 astronauts to its Tiangong space station as its construction enters a critical phase. The 3 blasted off from a launch center in northwestern China. They are the second group of astronauts to head to the space station since its construction began in April 2021. They will stay there for 6 months. The space station is planned as a 3-section structure. The core module was launched in April, and 2 more components will be sent into space in July and September. The new mission will oversee the integration of the 3 parts. The crew's commander has described the task as a pivotal battle in the construction of Tiangong, which is planned to be completed by the end of 2022.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Colombia's long hunt for a fabled Spanish ship, San Jose Galleon, that sank centuries ago, comes to an end. But the mission leads to 2 more nearby shipwrecks filled with treasures.
We have found 2 additional ships, one ship that is from the colonial period and another that, from the point of view of preliminary analysis, corresponds to the Republican period of our history. We also have related vessels, around a dozen similar boats, that will be located by our Navy.
The colonial-era vessels were found near Colombia's Caribbean port of Cartagena. A remotely operated vehicle reached 900 meters beneath to capture the shipwrecks and treasures inside them. San Jose Galleon sank in a deadly battle against English warships in 1708, taking with it billions in treasure. The Colombian president says the findings will be preserved and protected until extraction is done completely. The riches will then be displayed in museums.
Colombian scientists managed to reproduce an endangered species of frog, bringing it back from the brink of extinction. The scientists were able to reproduce 29 specimens of Lehman's poison frog after years of investigations and experiments using a lab built specifically for this species. They have released the frogs into the Colombian Pacific region with the hope of starting its repopulation.
We observe how the frogs adapt to this ecosystem, which is theirs, but it is a constant monitoring. And the idea is that of these first 29 frogs at the moment, there will be many more little frogs, and now we can tell the world that they are not in danger of extinction.
The scientists, however, warned that this particular species of frog is very difficult to reproduce or maintain under human care. They are also worried about the illegal trade of the frogs, which has already played a key role in pushing the rare species towards extinction. Colombia is home to over 700 frog species, more than any other country in the world except Brazil.
Chinese scientists are establishing a meteorological monitoring station at an altitude of 8,800 meters on Mount Komolangma, the world's highest peak on the China-Nepal border. The 13 members of the research team started the trek towards an 8,300-meter base camp on Mount Komolangma from a 7,028-meter camp on Tuesday morning. They reached the camp in the afternoon and went on the last section of the arduous journey up on Wednesday morning. If the station is established successfully, it will replace the one at an altitude of 8,430 meters set up by the British and U.S. scientists on the mountains in 2019. It will be the world's highest of its kind, according to the Chinese Academy of Sciences.
A bridge too scary for many, but just the right place for those with a head for heights. Vietnam has opened the world's longest glass-bottom bridge to the public.
The now recorded longest glass-bottom cliffside pathway, and it's spectacular, the engineering required to build that into the side of a cliff but maintain all the features of nature, the greenery, the rock, has been an amazing project, very successful, and I think it will attract a lot of tourists.
The White Dragon Suspension Bridge fittingly opened with a dragon dance. The structure is longer than the previous record holder in China and has two sections. One stretches over 630 meters between two mountains, while the other runs around a cliffside. Visitors can look straight down at the valley 150 meters below. The structure is safe and made from three layers of 40 millimeter tempered glass. The contemporary ceramics exhibition kicks off at the Villa d'Atres Art Foundation near the French city of Avignon. The exhibit showcases nearly 130 artworks of all sizes. Some are so big they are put on display outdoors. The foundation has created these modern forms from roughly 100 artists from all over the world. The exhibit displays an exceptional diversity of eclectic works presenting sophisticated skills and artistry. Participating artists say working with clay and playing with glazes always produces a unique item that often generates a profoundly universal reaction. The goal of the event is to show how ceramic art has returned to the forefront of the contemporary art scene.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
survey finds that most people think poverty is why pollution disproportionately affects black people, despite evidence that racism is the major cause. Stay with us for an article in this regard written by Brittany J. Miller, author. This article is published under the heading, Racism Drives Environmental Inequality, but Most Americans Don't Realize. Here's more. Most Americans do not think that black people are any more likely to be affected by pollution than white people, despite significant evidence that racism is a root cause of environmental injustice in the United States, a survey has found. Numerous research papers over the years have shown that people of color and poor people are significantly more likely to live in areas of high pollution, a result of deliberate construction of polluting industries in these communities, says Dylan Budgen, an environmental sociologist at Washington State University in Pullman. But Budgen found that respondents to the survey were more than twice as likely to identify poverty as the main cause of environmental inequalities instead of blaming structural racism. This is despite scientific evidence clearly demonstrating that race, rather than poverty, is the primary factor behind environmental inequality, notes Budgen in his study published in the journal Social Problems. Additionally, many people suggested that a lack of hard work and poor personal choices were responsible for increased exposure to pollution. The evidence here is strong. America is in a state of denial about its racism and the unequal impacts of environmental exposures, says Timmons Roberts, an environmental sociologist at Brown University in Providence, Rhode Island. To investigate how Americans view environmental injustice, Budgen devised two sets of questions. The National Opinion Research Center, which operates out of the University of Chicago, distributed these through email, telephone, and face-to-face interviews to households that were randomly selected and nationally representative. They received responses from 1,000 people. The first set of questions explored whether Americans understand the causes of environmental inequality, whether they think it is fair, and whether they support policies that address it. The results showed that only 1/3 of people felt that black people are more likely to experience pollution and that this inequality is unfair. By contrast, another 1/3 of respondents acknowledged that black and Hispanic people and the poor experience environmental inequalities but felt that it is fair. Most respondents, however, generally supported policy measurements to address these issues, such as compensating people affected by pollution. The second set of questions investigated how beliefs about hard work and social mobility, along with racial attitudes, influence American opinions about environmental inequality. Respondents, whom the survey characterized as having an underlying bias against black people, were less likely to understand the causes of environmental inequality. They were also more likely to think that pollution is more harmful to poor communities than black communities. Additionally, when respondents felt that people could get out of harmful living situations by, say, working harder, they were also less likely to think that black communities disproportionately experience environmental pollution. Thank you. Bajan says the results show that there is a widespread belief in the United States that everyone has equal opportunities and that existing inequalities aren't due to race. Instead, some Americans think that the only barriers facing minority racial groups are personal choice, responsibility, and hard work, he says. He calls this phenomenon colorblind environmental racism. The lack of understanding that racism is causing environmental inequality undermines efforts to fix those disparities, even when the data show that race is the biggest predictor of exposure to environmental hazards, says Sokobe Wilson, an environmental health scientist at the University of Maryland in College Park. To gain more public support for policies that address the role of racism in environmental inequality, environmental justice research needs to be better integrated into school curriculum.